Would you introduce yourself, please?
I am Dylan Cartlidge.
So number one, tell me about the small town. Tell me about the place that that documentary took place.
So it's a place called Redcar. It wasn't the place that, you know, I was raised. I lived there when I was 16, so a lot more of like an adult, you know, kind of like high school, college kind of year of my life. It's a beautiful town right next to the seaside. It's a very known, well, it used to be a mining town and then it turned into a steel industry, a very industrious town that produced steel mainly, amongst other things. And it's currently in a bit of a strange situation where it's in a bit of like, well, I guess a bit of a downturn because it's the steelworks have been mothballed. So it's just kind of in the wake of this massive enterprise and this massive industry that supplied so much lifeblood.
So real, so kind of like a small version of Detroit.
Detroit, definitely.
Right?
Yes. Detroit, right. 100%.
Which is kind of interesting because that kind of stuff gets into your blood. When it's an industrial town, that gets into your soul, doesn't it? When you're growing up around that kind of, because it's not an upscale experience. This documentary that we've all now seen the section of, how did they find you? Among all the people they could, they suddenly find this gentleman who's a server in a pub. How did they find you?
Long story short would be, the answer would be my mother. My mum works for the local council, which is, you know, kind of like the powers that be, you know, that kind of like govern, you know, the local, how everything is distributed locally in terms of education, resources, et cetera, et cetera. And my mum was actually worked for there well over 12 years as a careers advisor. So getting young people into employment that didn't have employment or getting young people into training and essentially telling people what to do and, you know, bossing people around.
That's a good person to have on your side,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, my mum definitely won't mind me saying this, but you definitely know she's around when she's, you know, she's there. And so where the first port of call when the people were looking to produce the documentary and research the area and research people who they might, you know, create characters from and da-da-da, is that they came to the council and, you know, for looking for young people in the area, they spoke to my mum and she mentioned me and mentioned the music and da-da-da, and that's how they first, yeah, first made contact.
So then does your mom come to you and go, okay, so Dylan, here's what I've done. I've given you this opportunity to get discovered. Did she come to you and actually tell you that she had helped you get cast in this real life film?
Well, it was actually the documentary people first got in touch before I'd spoken to my mum and called me on my phone and said, oh, you know,
oh,
we're
man,
doing this
so
documentary.
That was a surprise. Oh my gosh.
It was very much a surprise. And then she said, oh, yeah, those guys, I told them about you.
Nobody is an instant childhood prodigy. Age of 13 is what's bandied about. But I would imagine way before that, you had music that got into your head. Where did music get into your head first?
I guess from maybe ages 4 to 6, maybe. I remember very distinctly, you know, without going into too much detail, you know, with what was going on at home, I was very much left to my own devices a lot of the time. And I actually lived in a household that had a 90s techno DJ. That was like an in-house techno DJ, and I was, you know, on my own, you know, sat around the house, da-da-da, and I remember just constantly picking up trance tapes and also random CDs and cassettes that were left around and just basically listening to songs on repeat over and over again. Just lots of tapes. I had no idea. They just had really interesting looking covers, and I would just like listen to these random 12-minute trance.
It was like
songs.
A toy.
Yeah,
it was like a kid's toy, except it was the coolest kid's toy ever.
Definitely. And then from there, I just really, you know, I really got into rap music. I was really heavily into rap music. Artists like Kid Cudi, actually. Kid Cudi's music essentially saved my life, and it was the first time that I knew that, you know, music could be more than just an MP3 on a cassette player or a CD player or on your phone or something.
So let me go deep for a second, because you made the statement, so now I have to go there. Life wasn't easy for you early on. So when you say, because, you know, there's that famous track you've probably heard by In Deep called The DJ Saved My Life, right? But in truth, you really were upon, you didn't have an easy moment.
No, well, I essentially was in a household with my birth mother, who was you know, severely schizophrenic and refused to take any medication and those kind of things. And so the situation wasn't the best at home. And yeah, I essentially had to kind of like raise my younger brother and try and make a functional life as a child in a very adult world at that time. Yeah.
Tell me about Ruth.
Ah, yes. Well, Ruth, also known as Ruth Kilpatrick, is a phenomenal woman who used to, I don't know if she still does, but at the time she used to go through the screening process of artists who would play a local festival called Evolution Immersion in Newcastle upon Tyne, which was a really good local festival to get on if you want to get heard and da-da-da. And she was part of the screening process, but she actually was in London and had a few other things going on, and she picked up one of the songs, Love Spoons, through that screening process, and a little bit naughtily got in touch outside of the, you know, the Evolution screen
process. You're surrounded
process.
By people who surprise you, aren't you?
Definitely, yeah. Definitely. And she was like, you know, I shouldn't really be doing this, but, you know, I've just loved this song. I want to tell you that, you know, I'd heard it in the screen process. It really stood out. And just, yeah, keep doing what you're doing. And would you mind if I put this song in my little feature that I have in London called Record of the Day? And I said, yes. And
little feature.
And that's what happened. Yeah.
That's a good little feature to have. There's so much talk about the sound. And now I'm going to circle back to what you said. So now go back to what you called it.
Alternative hip hop.
Alternative hip hop. So now let's dig down, because, and we'll talk about the songs, but I mean, I listen to Monsters Under the Bed, and that could have been done by everybody from Wu-Tang Clan to the Talking Heads, right? And I mean, I'm going that wide, because what it's got is it's got a middle eight, it's got a hook. It's got signature sounds. Where did you realize that you kind of had a point of view?
That's a good question. To be honest, I guess it began before I actually started composing my own music. To be honest, before I began playing instruments or anything like that. I remember I started college in the UK, so when I was about 16, and I joined a music course to which they hadn't had a rapper on the course before, and they were like, maybe you want to do the technology course and, you know, learn how to use DAWs and da-da-da, and I was very persistent that I wanted to be a performer, and so they didn't really have any infrastructure to, you know, incorporate me into the course, because they had no tutors for rap, they had no none of these things, and so I basically had free rein and had to improvise, you know, in any way I can to be a part of this course. And so I remember the very first thing we did is, as a group, we got a load of random people, we got thrown together on this course, and we had, in a week, we had to play When the Sun Goes Down by Arctic Monkeys. And I remember just, I had to write a rap in it, and we performed it on the opening day, and it went down a treat. But to answer your question, I realized at that point when I was, you know, writing these raps and I guess presenting them in a way from, you know, what was kind of like introverted to me, to other people, and, you know, in the context of putting this into a song, to what people's expectations of me were, really, I guess, made me see how I viewed things, and I guess how people viewed how I viewed things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So, yes, I think that the term alternative hip-hop is one I use, is, I guess, is just a blanket umbrella, you know, term that I like to use, because, like you say, hip-hop is never usually associated with songs, and it's actually something that I try to use to my advantage. I think that it's been a notion for a long while. Obviously, it's breaking now with a lot more of, you know, Childish Gambino, Anderson .Paak, artists like this, that, you know, there is musicality in hip-hop, and it isn't just something that is a niche or a you know, a very small margin that you can just, you know, or flavor that you can just throw onto anything else and make something new, that it actually, you know, is very broad and diverse, and I guess has changed a lot to the point to where there's this whole outer field of things that exist that doesn't have a name, you know, because it's not hip hop as you would define it, and it really doesn't fit into anything else. And so that's really where I sit.
So this is tough, because you're very, you know, you're relatively fresh, but you're not as fresh as anybody thinks, because you've been developing this for, I'm not fooled here. You know, you don't get to where we're sitting here if you just came out of the womb and boom, I'm here and I'm Dylan Cartlidge and I'm going to conquer the world. Have you figured out, as you're moving forward, what the filter is for one of your songs when you know it is a song for you?
Yeah, 100%.
Ooh, good.
I feel as though, because my music, I feel it's something that's very cathartic, is that the word?
Cathartic,
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
And so it's something that whereby I know that a song is a song of mine, or I know that it's the right song to go with, is when I create it and I hear things in there that I didn't expect to hear. Talking Heads, maybe, you know, Ray Charles, or, you know, something just influence, or Wu-Tang, anything that comes out that sounds like I'm actually quite surprised by. I know it's the right kind of song, and I luckily, I guess through my experiences, I believe have had an ingrained way of, I guess, dysfunctionally in a normal setting, regulating my emotions to be able to turn it into some sort of song or something.
Best music is cathartic.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk business. We've been warm and fuzzy now. Let's talk business.
Yes.
So the documentary happens, the blog happens, you've got Discovery, and next thing you know, and again, we don't need to go through the whole tale because everybody can watch that moment when you went to London and went in that oddly shaped building, and next thing you know, you've got a publishing deal, which is pretty insane. And again, it's not that it's not worth going through it, but people can watch that moment. That moment has been repeated, and it's great. But I'm interested after that. You emerge from the building, you have a publishing deal. Now, you need a label, you need a producer, or maybe you don't need a producer, but you ended up on Glassnote. Yeah. I know that the story goes that you met with Glassnote and a bunch of people there quite a bit. You didn't just go, Glassnote is here, I'm there.
My manager, you know, David, I'll tell you that I was very, very, very frugal with, you know, everything. When I first came in, we went to meetings and everybody was saying, you know, where do I sign?
Hey,
how
babe,
do I make
I
a...
can do this, right?
Yeah,
there people. I know them well.
They were saying, you know, where do I sign?
Yeah.
How do I make $1 million?
I'm going to change your world, Dylan.
Exactly. And there was just lots of people like that. And, you know, the most people were walking in saying, where do I sign? How do I make $1 million? And I was saying, what happens if everything crashes tomorrow? And I guess I took that same approach.
Did you actually, in a meeting with Glassnote, say, what happens if everything crashes tomorrow?
Not those exact words, but pretty much that. You know, I almost said how many artists have been dropped in the last year, as opposed to how many artists have been signed in the last year.
What was it that sealed the deal? Was it looking Daniel Glass in the eye and him looking at you and saying, look, I'm from Brooklyn, I'm not effing around here? Because that's what I would get.
I think I can put it down to three things. The first thing being that even before I'd actually met Glassnote, I know you mentioned Childish Gambino, a big part of when I was, you know, coming forth as a solo artist. You know, sometimes you can be really talented, or you can, you know, make cool music that has a niche and da da da, but it might just not be the right market or the right time, you know, for that music to resonate or da da da. And so, you know, I was kind of in that realm. Do people want to hear, you know, elements of kind of left field hip hop from the 90s and the rock revival of early 2000s, you know, White Stripes, Black Keys, Strokes, etc. Now, you know, when that wasn't a revival itself. And so, you know, I asked myself those questions, but then in the, you know, 2017, I saw that Anderson .Paak and Childish Gambino had fantastic years, and commercially and also critically, people loved it. And Glassnote were responsible, you know, responsible for the success of, you know, one of those artists in Childish Gambino. And so that was a massive selling factor for me. Point one. Point two was the fact that, you know, when I went to do the whole day of meeting record labels, and, you know, over the weeks and months that followed, you know, going in the big Willy Wonka glass elevator style, oh, you know, we love your music, da da da. I actually met Glassnote, Laura, and also Liz from Glassnote, who's from the Glassnote UK team, just in a pub in London, just a random pub, and we sat down.
What a concept.
And talked about music. And then the third point for me, as you say, was actually meeting Daniel, and really just, you know, I'm very, like I was saying, it's a, you know, very cathartic thing, and I'm a very family-orientated person. I'm, you know, everything to me feels, when it comes to my music at least, is very personal, and I like to keep it that way. And so everybody that I have, whether it be, you know, a lawyer or a record label or a publishing, I like to feel as though I'm part of a family, and they're part of my family also.
So on the recording side, how much are you going to stay in the box, and how much are you going to go out of the box?
I think that my aim at the moment and what's on my mind, and has been on my mind since before the prospect of being a professional musician or an artist ever came to light, was that I wanted to make a record that encapsulated my experiences from hopefully an objective point of view, and turned it into something that was groovy and cool, but also a point of reference for, as Kid Cudi's was a point of reference for me, as certain topics and emotions and feelings. And I feel as though, when I was researching into making this record and I looked at different albums and people would say, this album was this or that album they did this, I feel as though my kind of like forte or my thing on the record to be is going to be the fact that I feel as though I'm at my best. I think David Bowie had a similar thing where he felt he was at his best when he was on his tiptoes in the swimming pool. I feel like my music is always treading the tightrope of being sounding all together and completely chaotic, from the fact that I'm not really a bass player, I'm not really a keys player, I'm not really a singer. I'm always floating the line of like being all together and totally disastrous. And I think that's exactly where it sounds best. And that's the same with, genre or anything else. And so I feel as though the record in my box is going to be actually tittering on the edge of the box.
Let's talk about Monsters, because you describe it as kind of a message from your birth family. But are these monsters scary, or are these monsters with a message?
It's a mixture of things. Definitely one being that, when I went to make the song, it just so happened that somebody from my birth family had been in touch and da-da-da, and that, kind of made me very unsettled and really rocked the boat a little bit. And so going into a studio session, it was never going to be the same after that. And this, undoubtedly seeped in. And it really raised questions about myself and I guess the world we live in, especially at the time, there's lots of things happening, scandals coming out about people in positions of power and da-da-da, especially, in the entertainment industry that come out, kind of like shared themes of emotions and the events that I was experiencing at the time that really kind of brought to the forefront what the song became about in the end.
Are you ready for this? Performing is one thing, but all the other toys that go with it. When you kind of sitting back and you actually have a moment to breathe, do you have some sort of methodology or way of thinking that you know is going to get you through the zillion meetings, the zillion showcases, the people with their folded arms in the back, the people who are going to say, no, on that third album, you got to make a left turn and do this and do this. Because again, watching that clip of you serving people and the energy that you had and the positivity that you had in what was obviously a demeaning job in a town surrounded by people that are definitely nowhere near a majority of them. They haven't escaped.
I guess that some of the things that you mentioned about the way that I am, the way that I was, as seen in the documentary, working in a bar and et cetera, and that there's maybe a lot of people in the area that didn't have that same outlook or a similar outlook positive in a positive way, feeling trapped in those kind of things. And I guess it's something that I feel as though, from my own experiences, I'm very lucky to be here. I think it's, for me, more of like a philosophical thing, and more like I feel as though, I don't know, but I feel as though, there's not everything is as it seems, and not everything goes to plan. And so in any walk of life or any job, there's always going to be pressure, stresses, respect, lack of respect, in any number of things that you can throw a hat on. And I feel as though to act differently in a circumstance, in most circumstances, based on those circumstances alone, is a little bit of a disservice to, it would be a disservice to myself, I would feel, if I were to let a situation make me change my character solely based on things that are relatively to, not only myself in past events, but a lot of people in the world, a very fortunate position.
What is going to surprise people about this record when it comes out?
I'd like to think the characteristics of it. I'd like to think that the ultimate aim for this is to sound like it to sound like me and to really feel as though with every song you get a little piece of me and you find a picture at the end of it. And I really, I think the thing that will surprise people is really just how hopefully unique to me it will sound. I think for me, when I, you know, look at great artists, you know, you some of the greatest artists that have, you know, existed, we rattle them off, you know, Bowie, Mercury, you know, Michael, they are some of the greatest songs ever written, you know, sound like they can be the grooviest things, but also can have some of the deepest meanings and some of the biggest, treasures and some of the highest peaks. And I feel as though there's an art in being able to, because I think anybody, the easy thing to do with talent or perceived talent would be to be able to just make a good song or to make a meaningful song. But I feel like it's a lot trickier to be able to take something that's good or take something that's perceived to be good and amalgamate that with something that's vital or important depending on the era or time that you're from.
So what I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside and then songs by others in between.